You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 17th of November 2012 here on Monocle 24. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew. A Swiss editor who's carving out her own niche on the newsstand, a British women's magazine that's doing its own bit to shake up the sector, and a new tasty-looking tome from Italy. All that ahead today on edition 12 of The Stack. Also coming up, we hear how Style.com, formerly the online home for the fashion magazine Vogue, is moving from the digital screen to the glossy page.
People talk about the death of print, or is TV going to be going in the long run? You know, where's music? But I actually think the audience wants all those things. They just want them in different combinations at different times. And so we felt, you know, there was sort of a opportunity to reach somewhat of a new audience, but also for our existing audience to give them something that we couldn't give them online.
That was Dirk Standard of Style.com, and we catch up with an editor-in-chief who's been put in charge of gently reshaping a 100-year-old German architecture magazine.
Mainly we target architects still, and people like who have an interest in architecture, but from a not from the point of view of I want to build a building, but rather architecture as a cultural topic is interesting to me. That's what we want to cover.
That was Alexander Gutzmer, editor-in-chief of Baumeister. All that and much more ahead today on The Stack. Hello and welcome to this 12th edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Burley. Well, as we started to wrap up the week here at Midori House, it felt more like we were just warming up as preparations are well underway for our upcoming Christmas market 2 weeks from today. And pictures and words started pouring in for our upcoming edition of Monocle Alpino, our special holiday newspaper. We'll have more on all of those projects, including a new book we're also working on. And that's going to be all coming up over the coming weeks. Of course, we won't have the book done by then. Anyway, it's now time to meet our guests joining us around the table on a very, very soggy Saturday morning here in London. Now we have two guest reviewers. I think they look reasonably eager to start tucking in, but I think everyone's sort of dealing with somewhat damp hair and an absolutely nasty morning. Nevertheless, Noemi Schwaller is the director and editor-in-chief of Dash magazine. Dash is the London-based illustrated title on fashion and fashion art. Welcome to Midori House.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I first picked up Dash, where I find sort of, you know, many new titles. It was up in Stockholm. I think I picked it up at Papercut. Where do you sit, and what was sort of the idea in terms of finding a position, of course, as we know, in a very crowded newsstand? Where did you see the opportunity?
Well, as a very arty fashion title, we are a biannual magazine, so definitely not a news magazine. We're trying to focus on background information. So we're filling a gap in the market while using different imagery, focusing on illustration. And ideologically, I would say we fill a gap as in we are supporting fashion illustrators, young and upcoming artists that have been a bit neglected in the last few years.
I want to come back to talking about doing a magazine in London versus doing it in Switzerland in a moment, but I want to introduce Rosanna Durham, deputy editor of O Comely. And O Comely is a magazine which I have to say many people who have been on the program so far have been referencing it as a title they're great fans of. Where do you sit in the landscape in the market?
O Comely.
Yes.
Well, firstly, thanks for having us on.
Not at all.
O Comely was set up kind of out of an emotion of rage and kind of a general feeling of being pissed off about the women's magazine kind of market in the UK. And a group of us kind of got together and really wanted to contribute to the field of kind of women's media. And so O Comely is the magazine that we created.
What was it? You said it was formed out of rage. What did you see, or what were you really responding to when you looked at, of course, what was on desks and bedside tables, etc.? What didn't you like that you saw?
Sure. So our editor-in-chief is someone called Derek, and he's Australian. And he came over to England and was quite shocked at the kind of low, kind of anti-intellectual kind of writing standard that you got in kind of current women's magazines that were on the newsstand. And he kind of reached out to his network of friends, and I was one of them, and we were trying really just to bring very high print standards and wonderful photography, personal and kind of intellectual kind of interviews, and, you know, really interesting copy, basically, into a mainstream title. Mm.
I want to ask both of you, because we've really... In a very curious way, we've seen a surge in so many fashion titles, you know, many focused on, of course, men, many focused on women as well, that are really going against, I think, you know, a lot of what you're saying, Rosanna, that, you know, there's, you know, we're so used to the A4 glossy format that, you know, whether it's titles that Ringier puts out or Gruner & Jahr, I mean, you know, all of sort of the major publishing companies around the world. And yet there's been this extraordinary reaction. You know, you were saying, Noemi, that, you know, you went with illustration. You want to go against the mainstream. How much? And I'm not a huge believer in research in myself. When one goes out to launch a magazine, I think you just have to sort of feel it in your gut that you want to do it. But did you sort of sample the room, talk to a lot of people, and then venture forth, or just feel you had something sort of, you know, burning in your gut and said, you know, this is something that there's just absolutely room to go and launch this?
Well, obviously, it was a vision in my mind, but I did a lot of market research and surveys and found out that there is very few titles, fashion titles, focusing on illustration. Some of them are a bit cheesy, so I really tried to do something more arty and aesthetic, mm-hmm. and trying to be sophisticated.
How did you wind up? Because, you know, Switzerland has got such a strong publishing background, you know, particularly when you look at books, but also, you know, for a very small market, a very strong tradition of newspapers, and also some very respected journals as well. Nevertheless, you wound up in London. Did you feel that this was something that would just be very hard to get off the ground, you know, be it in Basel, Zurich, Lausanne, Geneva?
Actually, I never asked myself that, because I did my MA in fashion journalism here in London, and this grew from my MA project. It would be more difficult in Switzerland to set up your own company. So in England, it's very easy to do form an LTD. So this was a reason as well.
Okay. Rosanna, I want to go back to also, and maybe to the same point about, you know, kicking off and launching this. As you said, you know, you have you know, a colleague who comes over from Australia, spots this opportunity, yeah. In the marketplace. Again, when everyone sort of, you know, gathered around the editorial table, mm-hmm. or wherever that first meeting happened, were you all sort of unified in that, in let's say his vision, saying, yeah, absolutely right, you know, there's room to do something, and then I venturing out to then to go and, you know, actually hit print on this, was there a bit of friction in terms of what the vision was? Because sometimes when it's a collective that comes together, there's often a bit of an editorial fire.
Well, there's certainly lots of editorial fire at Oakhamley, and I think that's what we all really enjoy, actually, is the kind of in-depth arguments that we have about what works in a magazine context and what precisely doesn't, and very importantly, what we feel, what kind of audience we're addressing through Oakhamley. When we came together, it's interesting, I think, you know, that there wasn't very much doubt in the air. None of us had come from a purely journalism background. There was experience in publishing and also quite substantive experience in news journalism as well. But as for the magazine market, looking back at it, interestingly enough, we really didn't know very much about the world that we were entering. And I don't think any one of us felt very connected to the independent magazine kind of sector in London. Mm. We were just running on our own energy and kind of the joy of creating something together.
Right. I want to perhaps throw in a bit of a talking point for us to reflect on. Dirk Stadden is the editor-in-chief of Style.com. Of course, both of you would be very familiar with it. It's owned by Fairchild, which of course is part of the broader Condé Nast empire. It sits in New York. And of course, it's a mix of industry news, red carpet reports, and said to be one of the most read women's fashion magazines in the world. Anyway, now Stadden has broke all the rules and gone from digital to glossy paper, launching the magazine to take on Style.com. During a recent visit to London, Stadden came into Midori House to talk to our editor, Andrew Tuck, about making money on the web and developing your own publishing style.
So, Tuck, first of all, a very simple question. What is Style.com and what's its ambition as a site?
Well, I think Style.com is generally acknowledged as the leading fashion website in the world. And I guess our goal is to maintain that position and to, you know, expand into all the new areas that are sort of coming up every day, whether that's mobile, in our case, taking a step back or a step forward and printing a print magazine. But, you know, our goal is to sort of be the leading fashion authority. When we first started, and the site's now 12 years old, we were the online home of Vogue and W. Having said that, though, it was always an independent editorial team. It was always an independent team producing, you know, content independent of those magazines. And just sort of 3 years ago, it became apparent that, you know, it was sort of redundant to be called that, and that, you know, Vogue and W ought to have their own sites that they were in control of. And so it's now W has its own site, Vogue has its own site, and, you know, Style.com has its own site.
And without causing too many political questions, to tell me,
there's nothing political about it. I assure you.
who is kind of keener to kind of grow up and walk away from each other in a way? Was there interest on both sides? Was it, you know, the editors of Vogue saying, "Look, come on, we need to do our own stuff now"? And on your side, were you saying, "Look, you know, we've got something here that's obviously an independent venture now. We need to kind of, you know, walk up and be off and be grown ups on our own"?
Right. Well, you know, like in, you know, all the best divorces, it was mutual. But, yeah, I mean, you know, it was a very strange thing because, you know, it almost happened by accident. Obviously, 12 years ago, I don't think, you know, anyone at Condé Nast really knew how big the web was going to be. So, you know, they were happy to sort of let Style.com go its own way. And it happened to grow up into this big thing, you know, which at that point, you know, it made sense for us to go on our own. And obviously, you know, Vogue wants to be in control of its own content. So, you know, it made sense from both sides.
And for you to make money as a site,
right?
It's interesting looking at, you know, all media companies. They have traditionally had a slight problem kind of migrating people from print to web and then getting to pay enough money. There's an expectation that it's somehow, because there's no physical piece of paper in front of them, that advertisers think it must be really cheap to do everything on the web.
Right.
Again, is that something you've kind of managed to inch up bit by bit to make sure that people do realise that you're trying to offer something that's premium and that they should be paying similar rates to what they'd pay in print?
Well, similar is probably the right word. You know, I'm not, you know, you don't have the same kind of margins online as you have in print, though, you know, obviously I think print is getting squeezed as well in that sense. But, you know, Style.com has always been a premium buy online. It's always been more expensive to buy than a lot of sites out there. And we've always done quite well with that because I think we, you know, we are such a sort of niche site and had sort of, you know, such a large share of that particular niche. So, you know, I think people have always sort of accepted that we could charge more of a premium for our advertising.
Now tell me, just as you were the I guess when you started, the Young Turks kind of changing everything around you, you're now surrounded by a whole generation of fashion bloggers who are being given front row seats. They're being courted by some of the big brands in ways that seems, you know, it seems remarkable for the reach they have. Does this concern you at all, you know, that you're producing something that's very kind of editorially driven, where you're taking great care over its production and its fact checking, and that you can corroborate everything on there, and then you're seeing these people who may be making quite wonderful looking sites kind of nudging up against you. How do you differentiate yourselves from them, or are you finding yourselves embracing them and trying to bring them into your brand in any way?
Well, in fact, we were one of the first sort of mainstream sites, as it were, to embrace the bloggers. You know, we had a long-standing relationship with Scott Shuman, the sartorialist. When his blog was, you know, literally, I think, 8 or 9 months old, he started doing his street-style photography from us, from the shows. You know, we now have a very good relationship with Tommy Ton, who does our street-style photography. So we have embraced that, but I think we only embrace it where we think it sort of makes sense and where it fits in with what we do and where the person, whether it's Scott or Tommy, has that, you know, eye that is, you know, on a very high level. In general, I think it brings a lot of interest to the field, all these new blogs. You know, I would say, yeah, I think there is maybe a bit of an indiscriminate embrace of some of them. And, you know, if, you know, again, the fashion companies went from sort of wondering, oh, online, I don't really need to deal with that, to, oh my God, I have to be in every place I can possibly be online and embrace, you know, every single person who has a voice out there. So I think that will shake itself out over the next couple of years. And then I think the sort of really good original voices will remain. And I think some of the others may fall by the wayside over time.
Now, interestingly, you refer to the sartorialist. So they, you go to any bookstore these days, there's a nice sartorialist book sitting there that embraced print. And you've embraced print as well. You've come out with a magazine. I think you're issue 3 now?
Issue 3 on newsstands just this week.
So. And why did you decide that it was time to feel some crisp paper between your fingers?
I think the audience these days consumes media in a lot of different ways, and they want that choice. People talk about the death of print, or is TV going to be going in the long run? You know, where's music? But I actually think the audience wants all those things. They just want them in different combinations at different times. And so we felt, you know, there was sort of a opportunity to reach somewhat of a new audience, but also for our existing audience to give them something that we couldn't give them online. So that was sort of one of the reasons behind it. I think from a business point of view, it's quite interesting. You know, a traditional magazine launch, you know, you spend a lot of money up front and then you hope to make it back somewhere down the line. With style.com, we already had this sort of great team in place doing the website. So, you know, there was a very small startup costs in that sense. And, you know, so the first issue was sort of immediately profitable. And I think from an editorial point of view, it kind of gives you a chance to do a certain kind of storytelling that you maybe can't do online. So, you know, it was exciting for us from that point of view.
And what's the distribution globally for the magazine? Is it still predominantly US?
Yes, it's predominantly US. It's a, you know, it's a fairly small distribution, about 120,000 copies, which I think is interesting because online, you know, we reach anywhere from 2 to 3 million in a month. But, you know, for the print, it was very much a niche publication. And that's because it's very much focused on fashion. It comes out twice a year after the ready-to-wear shows in New York, London, Milan, and Paris. Very much focused on what happened during that kind of intense month. And so, you know, it's very aimed at a particular audience.
And looking at over the horizon, over the next year or two, what do you think is the kind of path for both your site and for print, fashion print magazines in general, and for the websites, where do you think we're kind of headed?
I think in terms of magazines, and, you know, I don't know if this will happen over the next year, I certainly think we're headed to a place where magazines become more and more of a luxury product. Obviously, I'm not the first person to say that. You know, so I think some of the more newsy monthlies may have a tough road ahead of them over time. I think, you know, a lot of the biannuals, or twice a year, I should say, I think, you know, those kind of very luxury feeling magazines that appeal to a very specific audience will continue to do well. And I think we may see more of that. Having said that, Monocle, you know, and I am a big fan. I'm not just saying that because I'm on the show. I mean, I think you've sort of done this incredible job of, for a magazine that publishes every month, it feels like an event to me each month, and it feels like a very luxury product. So I think, in terms of magazines, they have to really feel like a sort of luxury product as opposed to sort of, you know, just a source of news.
And that was Dirk Stadden, editor-in-chief of style.com, having a bit of a love in there with our editor, Andrew Tuck. I wanted to ask both of you, and Roseanne, I'll start with you. It was interesting how he was talking about how a brand like style.com, you know, develops, making, you know, a very big name for themselves with all of the street style photography of the sartorialist, etc. Now, if we look at a magazine like yours, you know, in so many ways, it feels like a very deliberate reaction also against digital, too. I mean, it feels sort of, you know, wonderfully handcrafted and also, you know, just very refreshingly not commercial in a way, not playing the game. So I'll go back to your point about rage a little bit earlier on as well. Did you also want to push back slightly against, you know, having sort of, you know, the banks of ads of, you know, which you know, so many magazines, particularly in the fashion sector, have to have up front? Was there also quite a big discussion about, you know, how you would position yourself commercially as well?
Possibly not as much as there should,
should have been.
I mean, ads are useful and
absolutely
necessary, and often they're very beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
So we don't have a problem with advertising. I think we've always been interested in actually limiting the percentage of the pages in the magazine that's
sure.
turned over to advertising, to kind of preserve that feeling, that book-like feeling that we really sought after. But just to come back to your point about the internet, actually, you know, O Comely is a magazine that's been born out of the internet boom, and it really would never have been possible to have launched it successfully, say, 20 years ago.
Why do you think that?
For so many reasons. One, being able, a young kind of group of editorial, kind of ambitiously and kind of editorially driven writers in London wouldn't have been listened to, and also had the chance to prove that they could create their own magazine and make it work 20 years ago, and on the basis of the research that the internet, the information that the internet has made so much more accessible to young people who want to kind of do things. You can find out how to do things without having an existing network of people who will help you do it. Of course, there's also this feeling that blogs and, you know, very successful online magazines, for example, like Style.com and The Sartorialist and Rookie, and now more recently things like The Vagenda, they've really ruptured through the conservatism of voices in the established publications and given space for the potential of new magazines like O Comely.
No, we're just going to go for a break in a moment, but I just want to ask you very quickly. You know, your view in the relationship to the digital world and the web. I mean, to me, Dash feels very much also like a reaction because it is so tactile, it's so rich. You know, of course, illustrations and photography look great, you know, on a screen as well, but they never quite get the texture and depth, and there's such consideration for paper, etc. Do you feel what you've done is a reaction, or again, has been facilitated by the digital world?
I wouldn't say it's a reaction, it's just naturally, because, as you said, the print is much more precise in the colours and everything. But it also is like a whole kind of physical experience, the physical form of that magazine. It's the smell and the touch and the feel. And with print you get bigger coverage, bigger impact, all that counts towards it.
Great. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Alexander Gutzmer. He's the editor-in-chief of the architecture magazine Baumeister. But for the moment, you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're going away for a short break. Back in a moment.
J.Crew understands that tradition and modernity often lie hand in hand. That often means looking back in time for inspiration, pairing the integrity of traditional design with modern desires to fit and comfort. As head menswear designer Frank Mauchin says,
we're always inspired by art, architecture, nature, and we look at classic historical menswear, vintage army gear, and those were garments with integrity because they served a purpose. To us, J.Crew is about understated masculine elegance, and we're constantly tweaking proportions to keep the fit current and modern without being trendy, and so we're always moving. What makes it modern, I think, is the fabric and the fit. It's like modern traditionalism almost. You know, like the details are traditional, but then the fit, the fabric and the color, that's where you get all your updates.
J.Crew.
On Monocle's Culture Show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
And welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24, where I'm joined by Noemi Schwaller, director and editor-in-chief of Dash Magazine, and also Rosanna from O'Cumley Magazine. Now, I wanted, that would be also Rosanna Durham, you do have a last name. Now, you've got a number of things that you've brought in today. I have a few titles beside me as well, but maybe we should go to Berlin to start, because you brought in something, Noemi, which I haven't seen before. It's Ur Magazine. Which is really, quite extraordinary as a piece as well, just the way it's, from a production point of view, no traditional spine. You can see, the glue, and you've earmarked a number of pages. But what caught your eye about Ur Magazine?
Well, as you just made the remark on the binding, so the open thread binding was what spotted me at the first time. I really love how it's produced. It's an independent fashion magazine from Berlin, coming out twice a year, and acts as a platform for designer in Germany, especially in Berlin. It's done by Arne Eberle from Arne Eberle Press, together with Marvin Berlin. They do the concept of the layout and the production. And it's purely focused on images, so it's showing fashion without dictating a written opinion, which I really like. The idea really appeals to me. And each magazine shows 10 editorials, and each editorial's got different paper qualities. So that shows the flexible and versatile material paper actually is. And it's been a great inspiration for me. Also, one of the papers they used in the first issue is Amber Graphics, that we use for Dash Magazine now as well.
That's the matte stock that you use.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
It's one of the really curious things I like about it is that they put the contents at the back, which I think is a really interesting idea, just because, that I think is often the way people sample and they flip from the back of the magazine, depending on whether you're left or right-handed. But the idea of also doing that in the back of the magazine. Does this strike you as more of a portfolio? Because it's interesting, as you say, there's no written word. You have to make your own assumptions about what you see in terms of the images that have been deployed on page. Is it a photographer's portfolio? Do you think it's a portfolio for fashion designers? How do you also see it in terms of use, rather than, because it's a big production exercise, that goes into it, a lot of thought and consideration. So how do you respond to it?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a portfolio just for fashion designers, but for all people, creative people that are involved, so stylists, hair and makeup, designers, and just I think they have a lot of freedom to produce the shoots. So it's basically just showing what German creatives are doing at the moment and how they perceive, receive, and use fashion as their medium.
Rosanna, you've got a couple of things, but what would you like to start with?
I'd like to talk about Cabinet magazine, which is my favourite publication around, and I first discovered it when I was at university, and it's really the first magazine that I fell in love with. And it, for me, it just conceptualizes the intimacy that you can have with a publication. And I don't know very much about how it came to be, and I am very happy for that to be the case. I want to have this magazine that I come to a kind of afresh every 3 months and surprises me.
For people who aren't familiar with Cabinets, tell us about it and what it mm-hmm. does. And you can, of course, gush more about it if you want, as to why you get excited. It's a quarterly, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quarterly. It's called the tagline's A Quarterly of Art and Culture, and it's based in magazine. It's based in New York, and it's edited by a group of kind of lapsed academics, as far as I can make out. And so, yes, they attract quite a lot of academics and very established writers who are asked to write copy in a kind of clear and accessible style about very interesting kind of in-depth issues. And they have a theme for every issue. So the theme for the issue I'm looking at is punishment. And they give half of the magazine over to articles about that. And then they have just an open submissions. And they do wonderful things. They have long artist features, and they do kind of beautiful bookmarks and postcards, etc., etc. Feature that particularly appealed to me, this issue, and having studied psychoanalysis, it went kind of straight. It was such a win for me. Is a round table discussion with three generations of one of the editor's family members, and he talks to his grandfather about punishment in his kind of childhood and how then that was fed into his own upbringing, and then his own children have a chance at the end to ask, you know, can I not be grounded this weekend? And it's this three spread, very kind of intimate family discussion, and I think it's just wonderful.
I probably need not ask, but this is, it sounds like this is your favourite magazine. When it comes to a loved title, what type of relationship do you have? Because it's a question, you know, I love asking people on this program. Is it that title that you put away gently and you really want to devote time to it, as opposed to dipping in and out of it? Because I think a lot of people, you have some magazines that you like, but you want to dive into them right away. You know, many architecture magazines that I like, I sort of give them a very sort of quick flip, but I don't look at every single page, and then I put it away and I go back to it. What's your relationship with Cabinet?
Deeply possessive. I have a dedicated bookshelf in my room for the Cabinet publications that I've collected, and I see the magazine as kind of riding me through the next 20 years of kind of reading. I don't read it all when it arrives. I keep it kind of on the back burner. It's something I come back to. It's this beautiful kind of cozy room in my mind that I enjoy retreating to when I've had a kind of grim day, or I need to feel inspired and
on a day like
content.
Today, it sounds like you might sort of be retreating then back to the bedroom.
Yes, this afternoon.
Exactly. No, I just wanted to pick up on that point about collectability, and do you know the consideration of the spine of your magazine and everything that goes into it. When you sit down to produce it, do you often think about the life sort of beyond not just the newsstand or how it arrives on someone's desk, but often where it's going to be three months, 3 years later?
Well, I'm not sure we're collectible. I think it's more a coffee table book. It's not something that you read through in one go, especially because we have a lot of background information, longer text. We focus on a lot of content, and it's not something that you can just flick through. So
I wanted to ask the same question, just I think in the way that Rosanna is very passionate about Cabinet. What magazine do you have volumes of, and one that you feel this is, you know, whether it's every month, once a quarter, twice a year, that you get incredibly excited about? What would be your passion point?
The look and the feel.
But what title, is if you could isolate one or two magazines that you really like, which ones would they be?
That would be Dansk Magazine, Time Magazine, and I just love ID.
It's funny because Dansk is one which often people talk about, but we haven't had one. We had it around the table a couple of times, but oftentimes people bring so many magazines in with them as well that we haven't quite had the opportunity for someone to go through it yet. So I'll throw that challenge to one of you maybe in the coming weeks. We're going to go away for a short break. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
The designers at J. Crew feel that the best garments involve a mix of smart detail and solid functional design. As head menswear designer Frank Malchens explains, J. Crew's favorite products are the ones that start with smart design but last long enough to make them the customer's own.
it's to me, Delolo is a classic suit, but with a modern edge almost, but without it being trendy. And I think what we are in J. Crew here is we're looking for longevity and for classic garments which can lead a life. Like if you have a khaki pant, we make sure it's nicely washed already again, but you still have to do the work yourself again. You know, like year after year, the wash gets better and it gets softer and it molds around your body. The same goes for denim. And I think also that's a way to give a garment personality.
J. Crew.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, where I'm very, very happy to be joined by Alexander Gutzmer, who is the editor of Baumeister, which I have to say was one of the magazines that I used to fight with my colleague Ariel Childs, who is the managing director at our sister company, Wink Creative, when she was the creative director at Wallpaper and I was the editor-in-chief. Anytime Baumeister came in, it was like, where is that magazine? And for those who are not completely familiar with it, it had this, you know, very strict, I would say it could have been Helvetica, might have been Universe. I'm not sure what the font was at the time, but nevertheless, it just had this wonderful take on German architecture, German urbanism as well. But Alexander, you've been there now for 2 years as the editor. Something of a controversial redesign as well. I'm sure that in very august architecture firms all over Germany, there's maybe an eyebrow or two raised. But just tell us, where does Baumeister sit within the landscape of German architectural publications?
Well, I think that the eyebrows have gone down again in the architecture firms. What we did was we kind of reinvented architecture. I mean, the readership of architecture. What we found out, we did a research, we interviewed architects, we found out that there's two things these guys want mainly, which is inspiration and orientation. And these were the two promises that we wanted to give. And then we wanted to also redesign the magazine to kind of give it a modern and I would even say a stylish appeal, even beyond a little bit beyond the minimalistic approach it had before. So it was we wanted to do a journalistic magazine with a fresh and new and hopefully innovative design. And yes, there were some controversies, but I think there are a lot of people who say, okay, this was the right step, and you've got a unique unique position in the German architecture market.
What I liked about the old Baumeister is that It was an oasis of calm, and you know, just these very strict, rigorous covers. There was a silence, and you've managed to do the same, albeit in a very different graphic style. You've worked with an art director who has considerable fame in Germany. Did the original concept for Nido, and also is Freund still around as?
No, it is. No. It isn't. No.
Okay, but also, which was a great magazine as well that was designed, but it has also gone. I would say, and I say this in a positive way, it's gone a little bit more consumer. It has a cover now which could compete with other magazines. You know, whether it's an AD or whether it's an Architektur und Wohnen or something like this. Was that part of the brief when they brought you in 2 years ago as the editor, and Calvez is the parent company of the magazine? They said, listen, we would love to be able to increase our reach to let's say, the more lay consumer by 10-15%?
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, it was about also reaching younger architects. I mean, that was the first step. Our readership was, we didn't measure it precisely, but we assumed that it was rather old. And the idea was to really also get to younger architects, younger designers, people who are fresh from university.
So they weren't saying, you have to go and reach Frau Schmidt in Düsseldorf, who wants to go and talk to her husband about building a new bungalow.
No, and I'm afraid Frau Schmidt would still not find this bungalow in Baumeister. No, we still have, we target architects still. And people who have an interest in architecture, but from a... Not from the point of view of I want to build a building, but rather architecture as a cultural topic is interesting to me. That's what we want to cover.
Right. And what was the balance? Because you inherited something. I mean, the magazine is how old? It's 109 years old.
109 years. Yes.
Which is just remarkable in this day and age. Of course, you know, there are plenty of titles which have been around for a long time, but to be operating in such a tight and defined niche, did you feel there was a certain pressure taking over this mantle of heritage?
Well, actually, I didn't feel much of a pressure when I took over, but when we did the redesign and when some of the old readers told me, okay, this is no longer the Baumeister that we knew for 109 years, then I felt it, yes. But the company was very supportive, and something needed to be done. Baumeister was kind of, it was this, as you said, old, minimalist, niche of calm. But, you know, if you're a niche of calm, you're probably not going to survive as a magazine. So something needed to be done, and I did it, yeah.
Well, many would argue that the German market in general, in media, particularly in print, is something of a niche of calm as well. That whether you look at the daily papers, okay, you know, some years ago, you know, we saw, let's even call it excitement in Germany, that there were Sunday newspapers that, oh my goodness, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung is going to go with a Sunday edition. How crazy. That was probably, you know, one of the last big blips on the market. But, you know, and in a curious way, that's one of the very exciting things about Germany. It just, you know, I shouldn't even say it trudges along. It does push forward. Of course, you know, titles are still, you know, challenged in many ways. But we were talking before we went on air that there is this sense that just... Yeah, there's a feeling of stability, and even things are getting launched in Germany, that there's still a belief in paper and print, when in many markets, as you know, and this is, you know, we cover this topic week in and week out on this program, that many are retreating. Why do you think that is? Is it because we could say there's more publishing houses which are in private hands, the Mittelstand of publishing that gives it this stability? What do you think it is?
Well, it could be. What I think is basically that the German readership is, they are a bit conservative. They believe in what you call today content. They believe in longer stories. They believe in background stories. And they don't believe so much in, you know, crazy, for instance, in lists, you know, let's have the five. We probably wouldn't do the five most beautiful buildings of the last year, just because this doesn't go well in Germany. The readership is a bit conservative, and the readership still believes in print, and which is a good thing. And that was a chance for us also. I mean, if you look at the magazine, we're still very much word-based. It's not just images, for instance. Mm. We're discourse-based. Actually, we wanted to increase the discourse part of it. We have a section which is called Questions, where we try to ask in every issue 2, 3, 4 big questions and tackle them with essays, with long word-based interviews. So it's not as if we became Yellow Press, not at all.
Mm-hmm. We're looking at the cover of the November issue. What are the big questions that you're asking as we approach the end of the year?
Well, in that case we have a big round table about Hamburg. We have politicians, architects, designers discussing the future of Hamburg, because Hamburg is going through rapid transformations right now.
Everything which is happening with the Hafen City, the big harbor city project that's happening there.
And exactly. Not only Hafen City. I mean, Hafen City is biggest
one element.
Thing,
no, of course.
But also the whole area at the river bend is completely transformed, and also grown areas like St. Pauli, which, you know, has a strong tradition, and
the Reeperbahn kind of
the Reeperbahn. There's a lot of new architecture going on, of course. And the question is, does that destroy this spirit of St. Pauli? And that's the question we asked.
And where did you end up on that question?
It does. There is really a threat that St. Pauli is losing what made it unique. So,
That it's just becoming too neutered and maybe a little bit, just too vanilla.
Exactly. Architecture can destroy. You know, if you build the wrong thing at the wrong place or too much in a very limited time, you destroy the spirit. And then in the end, nobody wants to live there anymore.
Mm. I think that's curious today that that you invite this level of debate and you bring in urbanists and people on a political level as much as architects. And now, do you contain that discussion to your pages, or do you open it up because the fashion is that everyone has to have a say right now, and everyone should be able to go and comment and chip in. I'm no believer in this at all. Mm-hmm. How do you treat this? Because I think that is always a tension sometimes, because, well, when does, sometimes people do want to get to a debate and you want to know who won. Mm-hmm. And whether we've sort of, whether you think of sort of the presidential debates of the last few weeks or months, you'd like to sort of be able to declare a winner. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes when you've got this, this endless page of comment, well, it just rattles on and on.
Well, I mean, architecture, there's this meta debate, I think, on the development of the city. I mean, you can discuss it in Hamburg. You can have a similar discussion, of course, also in Berlin, in London. So I think it's an ongoing debate that you can also bring in into of course, Facebook, new media. That's where the discussion really, really goes on. So I think basically,
do you invite though and host that though? Do you feel that is the role that Baumeister should be there hosting that discussion all the time?
Most definitely, yes, most definitely. We try to be the platform to start, of course, new discussions, but also cover discussions that are going on anyway.
But do you feel your role as an editor, though, is also to moderate that discussion as well? Because, as you said, you can start it, but oftentimes, it can run away with your brand as well. And I'm wondering, I'm not sure what platforms it's living on, but are you also there, you as an editor, are you there reining it in and, keeping that ship on course?
Well, I mean, the discussions that we have on our blog, for instance, the problem is not that the discussions run wild. The problem is to initiate discussions that go on. I mean, if people discuss, our readership would always have a certain level. So the quality of the discussion is always there. The quantity would be the problem. Mm. There's a lot of, on the net, there's a lot of debate on architecture going on everywhere. If you Google architecture blog, you get 510,000 hits. So that means there are a lot of architecture blogs. People love discussing architecture, and we want them to discuss architecture through Baumeister.
Now, just before we go, what are you seeing on the German newsstand right now that you like? If we think of Alexander Gutzmer's, reading stack,
only from Germany?
No, anywhere. But I mean, of course, we've invited you in today because, of course, we want to hear what's happening in your market. So, a couple of things that are inspiring you on German newsstands at the moment, and maybe from elsewhere as well.
I think there's a fantastic magazine called Mu, which is celebrating Bavarian lifestyle. And because I think
Moo as in the cow,
Moo as the cow, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's a major trend that you try to cover local culture and find out what's really unique of places. And then there's another thing that does a similar thing, not from Bavaria but from Berlin. It's called Der Wedding. Wedding is the most kind of problematic area in Berlin, and this magazine is trying to see the Wedding from a completely different perspective. Also a very nice magazine.
Okay, I love those two tips. Alexander Gutzmer, the editor of Baumeister, absolute favorite magazine of ours. Thanks for joining us on The Stack. We're back in a moment. And we're almost coming to the end of The Stack. We're with Noemi Schwaller and Rosanna Durham. Noemi, you've still got a few magazines, but I'm only going to let you talk about one of them. So what would you like to chat about?
Well, I would choose another magazine that is relating to Germany. And it's called Husk, founded by Vince Hölzlen at the incredible young age of 17 years old. It started off with 5 issues of sort of a music fanzine. And now it's gone to real print since 5 issues. So they're trying to be biennial.
Mm-hmm.
This current issue is called Hyper-Romanticism versus Under-Reality. Interesting name. It's all about conflicts in lives, high and lows, happy, sad, depressed. And they talked to a lot of people about this and came to the conclusion that where there is an inner conflict, something very innovative and new can arise from. And I just really like the critical thinking in their articles, as well as the graphic design, which is done by Vincent Hölzl as well, together with Frederike Hamann, who was a Condé Nast in Ten magazine.
So it sounds like it's your version of Cabinet, maybe. Now, I gave you a copy of the title we were talking about earlier, which is A la Carta, which is a really interesting large format food magazine, somewhere at the intersection of fashion as well, but first impressions of it.
Well, I love the cover, which is a picture of a raucous dinner party left absent by all the guests. And there's kind of whiskey glasses and pears peeled and dirt, and kind of the food is deconstructed and eaten. And I think that probably conceptualizes how they're trying to kind of tackle head on the kind of fashion of hyper-styled food photography and fashion. So their recipes are on kind of the right-hand side of a spread, and then on the left they'll have a model kind of with, wearing garments that have a kind of tenuous connection to the food that they're using in the other recipe. So, yeah, it looks really, really fun and kind of very robust and kind of alive.
Yeah. It seems like something which it's the first issue, so it's numero uno. And I like also that you treat a food magazine though with a fall winter 2012 theme to it.
Exactly.
Was two lovely things where they have they do a meal quite early up front, but it's lunch with Alessandro Dell'Acqua, which is just lovely, and it's just this wonderful sort of spread, and this is just very human shot, and you want to be on this terrace tucking into, can't quite tell what it is, looks like it might be sort of, could be duck with cranberry, can't see at the moment, but then also they do a series of other breakfasts, a breakfast with Marco Glaviano, and then up front I think people are always fascinated by people's best meals. So they talked to Gianluca Cantaro from Manager of L'Uomo Vogue. He talks about Hirohiko Shimizu's Basara restaurant. And then they have Sarah Andelman from the creative director, of course, of Colette, talking about her favorite meals as well.
And they've got a really big type, actually, which I quite enjoy for the distracted modern mind who's used to kind of skimming on Guardian online and the five news outlets.
Yeah, that it's actually in a decent point size. Something disruptive about that, which is quite nice. And the other one I was just going to say that we have here is OK Periodicals. And while we were listening to the piece with Mr. Gutzmer, I think we sort of terrified ourselves. Like, OK, I flipped through this magazine. It was their sort of thriller issue. The tagline is pleasantly disruptive and always curious. And I was going, and I got this, and I almost jumped out of my chair. So they actually have thriller playing inside the magazine. Sorry, I was just interrupting you. Naomi, were you going to say something?
Well, I was just going to say that the A la Carta magazine beautifully underlines the erotic side of food and eating combined with fashion. It's a really great mixture. Yeah. And I finally see a lot of parallels to that, as we also have a recipe based on the trend season, trend colors of the season. And we have interviews with people from the industry that are called the Espresso Con or Gin Tonic Cons, and they have the lunch, dinner and breakfast with. I really like that concept too.
Naomi Schroller from Dash Magazine and Rosanna Durham from Ocom. We're going to have to leave it there. Our producers today were Don Trump and Adrian Craddock, and our studio manager is Sam Impey Beyond the Glass over there. If you have any comments or queries for us, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. Coming up in just a little over an hour, I've seen the sunny faces of Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson North. They are going to be here with the review at midday. And of course, we have The Monocle Weekly is back also at midday tomorrow, London time. But for now, for all of us here at the Stack in London, it is goodbye. Have a great Saturday afternoon, hopefully not as soggy as it is here in London. Have a good weekend. Goodbye.